From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Are you like Charlie Brown right now, chin resting on your elbow, commiserating with Linus as the snowflakes swirl around you? Are you disillusioned with the holidays and wishing you could hear that great story you heard on Only a Game last year about the hundreds of racing Santas braving the cold, clad only in Speedos? Well, ditch your disillusionment and stay tuned as we offer up that holiday goodie once again, as well as some of our and your favorites of the last year, which also includes soccer at the Vatican, doctoral candidates dancing for PhDs, and the mysterious-sounding but probably just very geeky elfish gene. Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. What do skimpy bathing suits, jogging, and jolly old St. Nick have in common? In December of 2008, we sent Only a Game's Doug Tribou out into the streets of Boston to find the answer.
It's a Saturday in mid-December. The skies over downtown Boston are clear, and the temperature is about 27 degrees. Boston resident Megan Coffey and Elizabeth Barry of Bedford, Massachusetts, have their running shoes on, and they have some advice on staying warm.
Jumping up and down. Keep moving. Doing jumping jacks, doing whatever it takes.
27 degrees isn't that extreme for dedicated runners, but Coffey and Barry are wearing only bikinis. They're two of more than 500 people stripping down for the 9th annual Santa Speedo Run, a mile and a quarter jog in which runners are encouraged to wear bathing suits and accessorize with holiday flair. Runners are registering inside Lear, a three-story bar on Boylston Street in the Back Bay, one of Boston's most popular shopping districts. John Iannelli is the run's co-founder and organizer. He says the idea was born when he and four friends were trying to come up with a practical joke.
We picked a weekend, we did it. We tried to recruit a whole bunch of people, and it was still just the five of us because everyone else was afraid. And so we ran down the street wearing Santa hats, Speedos, and carried a jukebox with a CD of the Muppets singing Christmas carols.
The stunt got a lot of reaction, and the men decided to turn it into a charitable event. The following year, they were up to 30 runners and raised about $2,000.
The fourth year I was in grad school, I had a little extra free time on my hands, and decided to just put some more structure to it. An organization built a website, put some minimums on what people needed to raise in order to participate.
The event has snowballed since then, and in 2007 raised $90,000.
Yes. Come on, let's go.
Today's start time is 2 hours away, but many runners are down to their swimsuits already and downing some liquid courage. Most runners get creative with their outfits. Judy Jakes of Newton, Massachusetts, describes hers.
A little Santa outfit with a lot of marabou around the edges, a red and black feather boa, a leopard print Santa hat, and a bell.
There's also a man covered in green paint with garlands and lights wrapped around his torso doing his best Christmas tree impersonation. Several women dressed as does have brown knit hats with ears and matching miniskirts with cotton tails. Kyle and Lana Grady of Somerville, Massachusetts, met at the 2005 race and were married this May. Kyle was wearing only a Speedo, sneakers, and a Santa hat when he introduced himself to his future wife.
You know, because you're dressed so scantily, you kind of see what you're getting involved in.
All of your questions are sort of answered up front. Is that the idea?
Bingo.
You can really find the love of your life at the Santa Speedo Run.
As the start time approaches, runners pour out into the street, and there's a lot of laughing, shivering, and calisthenics. When the run begins, hundreds of friends and family members line the sidewalks along the course. Organizer John Iannelli serves as the pace runner behind a police escort. It's not a race, and Iannelli stops the pack several times to do push-ups and put on a show while slower runners catch up. He says it's hard to keep the more eager exhibitionists from sprinting ahead.
Conflict there is that it's 27 degrees outside right now, and it's pretty cold. And it's a mile, and so even though it's a lot of people run outside in the winter when you're only wearing a Speedo, there's the urge to want to go faster. So it's a challenge to keep people under control that way.
The run ends where it began, and the party continues. One of the oldest runners is Leon Warner, and he's also traveled further than most. His home state, Nevada, and his age, 69, are painted across his stomach in blue. Warner ran last year and says he couldn't wait to come back.
Oh, I love it. I think this is the greatest thing that ever happened. I give to charities back home. My son lives here and he wants me to come and run with him. So I give to his charities and the things that he wants to do.
Every year, John Iannelli chooses one local children's charity small enough to benefit significantly from the fundraiser. Today's recipient is Cradles to Crayons, which distributes new and used goods to children in need. Chris Bentman manages corporate relations for Cradles to Crayons.
It only costs us about $25 to outfit one child with a package of clothes, books, toys, and everything that child needs to get through a cold Northeast winter. So with the money that we'll raise here today, it's simple math. For every $25 that we raise, that's one more child that we can help.
The next day, Iannelli reports online donations and runners' collections will be more than $175,000, nearly double last year's total. And that means a bunch of people running around in their bathing suits in December will help about 7,000 children. And was the Santa Speedo run everything first-time runners Elizabeth Berry and Megan Coffey expected it to be?
Oh, my gosh.
Way more.
Way better.
Yeah,
way.
It ended up actually being not as cold as I thought it was going to be.
No, everybody's in the spirit. It's just such a great
it's
time.
For a good cause, yes. So it's really well worth it.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribune.
The 10th annual Santa Speedo run went off 2 weeks ago without any hitches. All proceeds will benefit two charities. Crossroads for Kids operates summer camps and provides year-round support for at-risk youths. Bottom Line is an organization that helps disadvantaged youths get into college and to graduate. It's not unusual for the Sugar Plum Fairy to dance in December. After all, the Nutcracker Ballet has become a favorite across the globe. But this particular Sugar Plum Fairy comes to us from Australia via YouTube, and instead of celebrating the bravery of young Clara and the Nutcracker Prince, she's delivering marshmallow glucose to dancers representing the beta cells of the human pancreas. A fifth dancer leaps around with a flashlight to represent the crux of this particular Sugar Plum Fairy's PhD thesis, the effect of vitamin D on insulin production. Why would graduate student Sue Lin Lau be doing such a thing? Because the gonzo scientist challenged her to do so in the second annual Dance Your PhD contest, which was held in October of 2008. The gonzo scientist himself, John Bohannon, gave grad students, postdocs, and professors 6 weeks to create and film a dance based on their scientific research. Bohannon joined me a short time thereafter, and since I had assumed scientists are pretty busy people and not really known for their dancing ability, I asked him if he had gotten more than one or two entries.
Well, that's what I had feared, but the amazing thing was that in the end, about 100 scientists took part, producing 36 dances.
Well, obviously, our scientists are not busy enough doing science.
Well, if you watch every single dance and read the accompanying text that mm-hmm. each of the scientists wrote, mm-hmm. you actually learn a lot of science. So I think a lot of people feel this is okay because it falls within public outreach.
How do you decide a winner? Is there some relationship between the two, 60-40, 50-50?
So that was tricky. I worked this out the first time around. I said to the judges first, watch this dance as if you knew nothing about the science. Just judge it on its merits as a dance.
Mm-hmm.
Then put on your science hat and say, how cleverly did they extract a piece of their research to translate it? And that's a hard task, especially if you've got a very complex PhD. You can't just tell the whole story with every detail. You have to choose some nuanced inner part of it And so then they had to judge how well they extracted that. And then the final category was how well did they bridge those two things? How well did they bridge art and science? Uh-huh. And each of those was a 10-point scale for a possible total of 30.
As I mentioned earlier, scientists are not generally the best dancers at the prom or the spring social or at their reunions. Were you worried?
I challenge you on that, sir.
Oh, you do? Oh, excellent. Well, tell me about it. Perhaps I'm completely wrong.
Well, so, you know, I had the same notion until I became a scientist. My dad's a scientist. Actually, maybe he's not a good example because he's pretty wild on the dance floor. But I went to a number of scientific conferences back before I was a journalist, when I was a scientist, and I always had the most amazing time at the dances. I find the scientists are amazing dancers.
Winners, of course, get a chance to see their works reimagined by an actual professional choreographer. The finished works will be performed at the annual meeting for the American Association of the Advancement of Science in February. Will those dances, do you think, be similar to what we've already seen on YouTube?
I doubt it, actually, for two reasons. One is that I think the choreographers who are creating those dances right now as we speak will be mindful of creating something fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And the second reason is that they're not interpreting the PhD of these scientists, which is what generated the YouTube dance. Instead, I've asked each scientist to hand over some current research, currently published research, and their task is to answer any question that those choreographers have until they actually understand the science.
I see. And so did you pick choreographers who would at least be able to ask intelligent questions?
Well, it was a self-selecting process. So the choreographers who were the most interested in taking part in this project are hidden science geeks, in fact. Some of them are actually married to scientists.
This is the second Dance Your PhD contest. How did the idea for the first one come to you?
I was drunk, honestly. I just want you to know the reality. You could also use this answer. There was a big party that was going to happen in Vienna with a molecular biologist DJ. He made music that was based on samples of noise taken from molecular biology labs.
Oh.
So DNA sequencers, the mating dances of fruit flies. There are a lot of bizarre noises in the laboratory. Anyway, so he was going to have this DJ event, and it was going to be piled high with scientists. And so I proposed, well, let's add something to warm them up to get the dancing going. So that's when I proposed that we should do a dancer PhD contest. And I filmed it. Emails just started pouring in from all over the world, mm-hmm. from scientists saying, well, when's the next PhD dance? And since these scientists were all over the world, including Australia, it couldn't be a real live event. I'd have to make it on YouTube.
You call yourself the Gonzo Scientist because you participate in the science that you cover. So will you be dancing?
So I participated in the first one. I guess I'd call it a surreal breakdance interpretation of a genetic network. I think there's an implicit rule that once you've danced your PhD, it can never be done again.
John Bohannon is a contributing correspondent for the journal Science, and he's the founder of the Dance Your PhD contest. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
And thank you.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Bicycle riding is good exercise, good for the legs, good for the heart, but bike riding is not good for stealing a Christmas tree. Recently, police in Portage, Indiana demonstrated this by arresting Philip Menefee as he rode away from a Christmas tree lot with a tree balanced on his bike. Confronted with the accusation that he'd stolen the tree, Menefee claimed that he'd purchased it. When police pointed out that the farm had been closed for hours, Menefee said he'd bought the tree at the bar where he'd been drinking, which explains why the officers concluded that alcohol may have been involved.
Promise you will be nobody else's little Christmas tree. I'll make you sparkle, just you wait and see.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Geeks Have It, the Elfish Gene. But first, for 3 months each spring, international men of the cloth battle each other with surprising ferocity. This Holy World Cup of sorts provides more than a chance for the Pope to wave his foam finger to the heavens. the Catholic Church wants to give an image makeover to priests and sports. In May of 2009, Only a Game's Nancy Greenlease journeyed to the Vatican to see the cleated clergy and flopping friars.
Early on a Saturday morning, about two dozen athletes in sweatsuits gather in an unusual clubhouse. Papal crests decorate these walls, and there's also a photograph of the league's director, Pope Benedict XVI, who beams down at them. The seminarians from the Pontifical North American College read from their playbook, packed with scriptural passages and psalms.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and will be forever. Amen. The glory of these 40 days we celebrate with songs of praise.
Today, these young men will sweat over more than the scriptures. They'll play another seminary made up of mostly Brazilian seminarians and priests, the Colegio Brasiliano e Orionino. They're competing for the coveted Clericus Cup in an annual tournament that pits seminaries against each other. The tournament derives divine inspiration from a former goalie and Pope, John Paul II. His sports foundation organizes the Clericus Cup along with Italian sports authorities and the Vatican. Seminarian Victor Ingalls says the late Pope, who also skied and swam, encouraged priests to be active outside the walls of the church.
John Paul II said, you know, the spiritual life is obviously important, but everything builds upon just the human being. Like, we're all human beings, just like everyone else. We're just guys, just trying to do the Lord's will.
Piled on a bus, the North American seminary team heads off on their mission. A few minutes later, the bus stops near the field, and we walk into another country, the Vatican. A wall surrounds this city-state. Even men of the cloth need permission to enter, which they receive.
One, uno, due, cambi più forte. Sì, veramente.
Players warm up on the small field. The North American team gets some last-minute advice from its coach and goalie, Gannon Jones. He says that being as quiet as church mice won't win games.
We really need to shout and talk to each other. That is the key, that is the difference between any player, between any side. If you're not going to talk, or if you're just going to talk in a conversational tone, there's no point being on the pitch.
As the game gets underway, the bench shows, however, that they haven't taken a vow of silence.
Get that ball in the net!
There you go, win that! Win that! Pass, pass, shot! Good one! Yeah!
In no time, it's one zip for the fit North American squad. They're nicknamed the Martyrs. As one seminarian jokes, even when we lose, we win. One of the tournament's goals is to set an example that soccer can be played without violence, greed, or corruption. Charlie Gallagher is the Martyr's tall, lean forward.
We hope to carry, when we play on the field, the same kind of virtues and temperament that we have off the field, too, to keep peace of mind and charity, of course. But we still all play very hard, and we all want to win with, you know, equal determination.
You didn't have to go to confession after a game?
No, you could talk to my spiritual director about
it. Priests, he admits, are only human. During last year's tournament, one African priest threw his shirt at the referee. He earned a red card and probably more than 10 Hail Marys. And in today's match, members of the North American team have gotten a little hot under their collars. As their three-goal lead disappears, they're nailed for being offsides.
What? Number two is all the way back!
The Martyr's Daniel O'Mulane shows his displeasure by stretching theatrically. The referee holds a yellow card to the heavens. On the sidelines, the North American Seminary's spiritual director isn't fretting over soccer sins. Father Dick Tomasek says soccer benefits these young men who spend hours studying and in silent prayer.
I think they get a feeling of their wholeness, body, mind, soul. You know, the mind and the soul are exercised all the time in their life, but the body is not.
The church also wants these seminarians to return to their home parishes and start sports teams, a tradition that has lately died out. The church sees it as a way to connect with kids. That's what happened to Father Tomasek when he was attending his parish's grade school in Iowa in the 1950s.
We got this young priest who took off his black shirt and in his undershirt played basketball with us during recess. And I tell you, I think that's when I started to think I could be a priest. I saw a priest doing something, enjoying it, being good at it, and playing with us.
Clericus Cup officials hope this tournament promotes the priesthood, a calling that they admit needs some marketing. Seminary student enrollment in the U.S. has plummeted more than 85% since 1967, according to Georgetown University researchers. A group of U.S. priests contend that the vow of celibacy discourages many young men from entering the seminary. Father Oscar Torian says the priesthood is getting unfairly labeled.
Nobody really wants to be a priest because, oh boy, you know, I'm a loser and a loner.
Torian manages last year's champion, Mater Ecclesia.
I don't feel like being a priest is to be a loser or a loner. I do a lot of good things, you know, I really feel myself, you know, a winner, you know, a born winner.
The players on the Brazilian team's bench are quick to point out their winning ways. Jose Barbosa, who seems to have enjoyed the Italian pasta, says this season is merely training for next year.
I think I'll play in the future with either Inter or Milan, perhaps, with Ronaldinho, Pato, Kaka. I learned to play with Ronaldo, the phenomenon. Yes, I did, watching him on TV.
Joking aside, the Brazilians say soccer is another form of salvation in the poor communities where most will preach. They'll start church teams that will provide inexpensive fun and a diversion from drugs.
Game. Oh my goodness.
The Martyrs clinch the win 4-3. Both teams form a big circle on the field for what they call the third period, the closing prayer. The game has strengthened not only their bodies, but their faith. Sweaty and tired, they give thanks.
Venga il tuo regno, sia fatta la tua volontà, come in cielo così in terra. Dacci oggi il nostro Padre quotidiano.
For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlace in Vatican City.
Amen.
God's footballer hears the voices of angels above, the choir calling you. God's footballer stands on the doorstep and brings the good news of the kingdom to come. While the crowd sings, Rock of Ages and the gods bring weekly wages. The glory of the sports pages is but the worship of false idols and tempts him not.
Of Dungeons and Dragons, the fantasy game into which he plunged headlong as an adolescent, Mark Barrowcliffe writes, "An obsession is a way for damaged people to damage themselves more." Happily, as an adult, Mark Barrowcliffe gained the perspective from which he could write about his obsession and his eventual escape from same. The result was a book published in late 2008 titled The Elfish Gene, Dungeons, Dragons, and Growing Up Strange. I was concerned that some of our listeners might not be familiar with Dungeons and Dragons, so I asked Mr. Barrowcliffe to explain his assertion that the game is unprecedented in human history because it's a story you can listen to at the same time you're telling it.
Well, briefly, it's a kind of narrative story. The best way of describing it I've come up with is that it's like one of these World of Warcraft games or something like that. Computer games before they had computers. So where in the computer game you'll see a generated image, in Dungeons and Dragons you'll have that scene described to you by someone who's gone through beforehand and designed this entire world according to a set of rules. So he'll say you're standing before a heavily embossed wooden door, lights pouring out from under it. What do you do? Well, we send our thief to the door, a specialist thief, and he listens. Well, he can hear the sounds of goblins talking behind. Okay, we all draw our swords, bash down the door, in we go. Yeah, girls love this stuff, believe me.
No, yes.
There's a set of rules which determine, you know, how you fight the goblins. In fact, there's a set of rules that determine everything from your hair colour to the weight of the rations that you're eating. Hmm. So it's a fantasy world delineated in pen, paper and the imagination, rather than a fantasy world delineated in computer bytes.
The boys inclined to be fascinated by such things as imaginary wizards, mysterious fireballs, dungeon-dwelling monsters of various kinds. They tend to find other similarly obsessed dweebs. This is your word for that group. But of your early Dungeons & Dragons days, you write that you were too nerdy even for the dweebs. That must have been a discouraging discovery.
Well, it was terrible at the time because I was actually ostracized by my group. But in my small defense, there's not much in my defense, but in my defense, I was just nearly 12. And a lot of the guys I was playing with were nearly 15 or 15. And that's a big difference. And I was an immature 12-year-old. And to be fair to them, they were immature 15-year-olds. but we were both, you know, I was probably had a mental age around 8, and they probably had a mental age around 12. I mean, the game was all my dreams come true. I'd been a major fantasy nut as a kid growing up. Read The Hobbit until the words came off the page. And to be able to act all that out was just terrific to me. And unfortunately, I did actually act it out. You know, why call on the ancient powers to smite thee down, sir? You know, just roll the dice and shut up, Mark. You know, it's like these guys who play this game, a lot of us anyway, not everybody, but those of us who are real obsessives, were obsessed with kind of sophistication. And as with a lot of human behaviour, liking D&D is a way of feeling better than other people, i.e. we have this secret code, we have this secret world, which you jock, know nothing about. And, you know, if only you were more intelligent, you would like it too, and you'd stop that gym class because you'd know that this was much more important. Important, that's how we felt, important.
Among your fellow players, the one who struck me as most remarkable was Billy Crowbraw. I hope I've pronounced that correctly.
Well, you've pronounced it correctly in American terms. It's Billy Crowbraw.
Crowbraw.
Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you first met him and the impression that he made on you.
Well, Billy, as I say in the book, Billy looked to me exactly like a golden dragon would have looked had he decided to appear as an extremely overweight schoolboy. He had a kind of bright plume of yellow hair. He was very, very fat, very expansive in his way of talking, smoked cigarette after cigarette, you know, at age 15. He just smoked one off the other and could quote everything from Shakespeare to physics, chemistry. I mean, he seemed, at the time, to me, he was easily the brightest and most impressive person I'd ever met. You know, when I first met him, he was sitting in a war games club, smoking away. And I said, "Oh, can I sit next to you?" And the first thing he said to me was, "Sit down betwixt the wind and his nobility," and let out this enormous fart. This is typical of Billy. It's not just something he trotted out. I got the feeling he could have done anything, really, in his life, almost anything, other than meet a girl. I mean, to his... He was always fat, very fat, and that was unusual in England in the 1970s, very unusual. And I think that kind of obviously gave him pause with girls, really.
Well, we need to get into this whole issue of girls and their absence in the Dungeons & Dragons world.
You say that wrong. If you're going to say girls, as we would have said it when we were D&Ders at that age, you have to say it like this. You have to say, "Girls!"
I don't think I can do it. I'm going to count on you for that.
And then you have to go absolutely bright red and put your hand up to your forehead and hide your eyes
kind of thing.
Which is how I used to react to the presence of my friend's sisters very often.
I'm talking with Mark Barrowcliff, author of The Elfish Gene, and you're listening to Only a Game. You write of yourself in these D&D days that you were, quote, a bullied, power-hungry twerp with no discernible skill in conventional fields and no immediate hope of a girlfriend who wasn't mentally ill. To what extent was the discovery of the opposite sex responsible for the end of your days as a fantasy gamer?
Well, 100%, because in groups like ours, I know there are groups that have women in them. In fact, a reasonable percentage of the sales of role-playing games go to women. But in our group, it just could not have sustained that, because any girl that I ever brought into that group would have immediately been the target for ridicule, horrible practical jokes. And I can remember one of my friends saying to me when I got this girlfriend, oh, you know, you should bring her to this rock festival we're going to. He said, you know, if you go to this rock festival, you'll be able to, you know, you'll be able to, you know. And I was, what? He said, you'll be able to sleep with her. And I said, well, we do that already. And his face kind of contorted into the shape of a sort of bright red walnut. And he just said, no, you don't. And I said, well, we do. And the next game I had, I was subjected to about 2-hour interrogation on what's it like in order to establish whether I was lying or not. And at the end of it, they concluded that I was lying because it wasn't exactly as one other boy had described it. Having said that, they were right. I was lying.
I should mention that, you know, you did your job as a researcher in preparing to write this book. You actually returned to the Dungeons and Dragons table as an adult before, you know, finishing the book. How did that go?
It went awfully, and everybody that I went to this game with was depressingly exactly like the boys I'd played with when I was 15. I mean, this one guy, he said, oh, you're a writer, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And he said, what format do you use? And then he kind of went on about computer programs of some sort. And I said, no, I'm a writer, I write books. He said, what, like on the shelf? And I said, yes. And he said, well, you've got a publisher. Yes. You can buy them in shops. Well, some of them, yeah. And he kind of balled up in on himself and just said, well, I think you will find that I am a consummate storyteller. And I was... yeah, mate, yeah, well, good. Well, pleased to hear it.
Mark Barrowcliff is the author of The Elfish Gene, Dungeons, Dragons, and Growing Up Strange, a memoir. It's published by Soho. Mark Barrowcliff joined me from the BBC studios in Brighton, England. Mark, thank you very much for speaking with me. It's been a delight.
Thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Fans of the arcade game Whack-A-Mole, in which participants get to bonk the heads of the little critters as they pop out of holes, have proved to be especially enthusiastic about a variant of the game called Whack-A-Banker. Tim Hunkin says his customers at the arcade in Southwold, England, pay 40 pence to hit as many bald, identical-looking bankers as they can in 30 seconds. It's proving very popular, Mr. Hunkin reports. I keep having to replace worn-out mallets. Mr. Hunkin contends that the bankers never really lose, since whackers who win the game are rewarded with a banker's voice crowing, "You win, we retire, thanks to the taxpayer for paying our pensions."
Opportunities!
All manner of private enterprise!
Shipyards!
The mercantile!
Collieries!
Canneries!
Corporations!
Amalgamations!
Yes!
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the competition lumbers along in New Hampshire. But first, golf vacationers have traditionally gone for destinations like Florida, California, perhaps Augusta, Georgia, or even Scotland for a few scenic rounds. A while back, Ron Chambers of Apex, North Carolina, traveled 9,000 miles to try out some of the courses in a country that's recently been luring linksters, Vietnam. In the February 2009 edition of Golf Magazine, Michael Walker Jr. wrote about the rounds Chambers played in the country he had last visited as a Marine. About the time that article hit the shelves, I was joined by Michael Walker Jr. and by Ron Chambers, and I started by asking Ron whose idea it was for him to return to Vietnam as a golfer 40 years after he had left the country.
It was Golf Magazine's idea. I think it's a story idea that Michael had.
And did you actually play? I just have to get this straight. Did you actually play on courses that were part of something called the Ho Chi Minh Golf Trail?
Well, yes. Yes, we did, actually. I'm not sure the trail ran right through the first fairway, but they were very close.
Michael, can you describe what it's like to arrive at one of those golf resorts?
Oh, certainly, certainly. I think the real place you saw how dramatic it was in Da Nang. You come back there, it's a beachside resort, so it's really where a lot of the focus of the redevelopment's going. It's like you might imagine what Cancun looked like in 1970 when they sort of just picked out where the big beach resort would be. There's huge signs, there's like hotel coming here, hotel coming there. They're actually relocating graveyards to build hotels and golf courses, and all this coastal land they're hoping will become this great place for these golf destinations and beach resorts. And to just drive through it and then think, you know, this is Da Nang, this is where all these things in the war happened. It's almost surreal.
Michael, in the article you write that there were a couple of moments when you saw Ron suddenly begin to look more like a 25-year-old Marine. Can you describe those moments?
Yes, it was really interesting. One of the courses we were on had a bunker that the French had built during the previous Vietnam War that the American troops used later. And Ron went down inside to sort of show us how they were being used in the Vietnam War. And as he went down, he talked faster. His movements seemed to quicken. It was just as if the memories coming back sort of brought him back to a different place. And it was just really remarkable to watch.
Ron, is that something you were aware of at the time, that you were talking more quickly and your movements were changing?
Not really, not until Michael told me later. But when I got down there and suddenly I just remembered all the military stuff that you learn, and I was explaining to them about the fields of fire out of the bunker and things like that, I didn't quite know where it all came from, really. I hadn't thought about it for years.
Ron, at one point during your trip when you were not on the golf course, you met with a man named Phan Van Dung who had fought for the Viet Cong in some of the same areas where you had been stationed. Of that experience, you said, quote, "I felt comradeship." Did that feeling surprise you?
Yes, it did. We were pretty bitter enemies back in the day, and although that's been a long time ago now, he was very cordial toward me, and I was the same towards him. Mm-hmm. But when you look around Vietnam, I mean, 70% of the people are under 30, and only old guys like us even remember the war. And we both sort of looked at each other, and we realized that I think we both simultaneously felt some comradeship.
Michael, you found that at least some of the golf resorts, and there are a lot of them, that have appeared in Vietnam are trolling for pretty well-heeled golfers. Rooms at the Nam Hai Hotel in Da Nang start at what?
Oh, I think they were starting at maybe $500, $600. I mean, when you go into these hotels and these golf courses, I mean, it's really online of what you'd expect to see in a really nice resort outside Scottsdale or maybe Cabo. They're definitely not going after your weekend golfer, your daily golfer. But these are, you know, targeted for businessmen in Asia taking trips over and certainly, you know, more adventurous Americans who might take a trip over. But this is a high-end golf destination. Mm. It's not for, you know, the ham and egger weekend round.
Well, I wonder if you're anticipating that your article will result in more golfers from the U.S. heading for the Ho Chi Minh Golf Trail.
I think it would put it in people's head as a destination. It's still a long flight. It's a long way from home. But I think, yeah, sure, adventurous golfers who want to go to different places, and particularly men like Ron who have these memories from back then. Yeah, I'd hope to see more people going over there. Absolutely.
Ron, I would think the memories from back then angle might cut both ways. Did you have any hesitation to going back to Vietnam?
Not at all. Initially, when Golf Magazine and Michael invited me, I was very excited. But curiously, just as I was getting ready to go to the airport, I began to get really apprehensive. I mean, rationally, I knew I was going on a vacation to play golf, but sort of subconsciously, I began to get nervous, agitated. I mean, I looked on the floor, and there's my golf bag. It was not a Marine Corps sea bag, but it was a very strange feeling, and I suddenly found myself thinking, I wish this was over. Why did I want to do this? because I had those same feelings I had in 1967 as I left. You know, apprehension, probably some fear, and I was having it all over again. But it left after I got underway.
At one point in the article, Michael writes that you said, "I keep asking myself, why does anyone fight wars?" Can you imagine that someday, 40 or so years from now, some former U.S. soldier will be playing golf in Baghdad and maybe asking him or herself the same thing?
I absolutely can imagine that. I hope it'll happen.
Ron Chambers, ex-Marine and current golfer, joined me from Raleigh, North Carolina. Ron, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
And Michael Walker Jr., who wrote the story of the trip Ron Chambers took to Vietnam for the February issue of Golf Magazine, joined me from NPR in New York. Michael, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having us, Bill.
When Dartmouth College was founded in 1769, it was built in a place called the Royal Province of New Hampshire, and its charter was provided by King George III of England. Today, New Hampshire is no longer a colony, and Dartmouth is a member of the Ivy League, but some things never change. In May of 2009, Only a Game's Karen Given reported from Hanover, New Hampshire, on a collegiate endeavor that brings back crosscut saws, large metal axes, and lots of lumber.
Really quite sharp as an instrument, and you know, it has sort of a tone with a lot of teeth in it.
The 63rd annual Woodsman's Weekend at Dartmouth College starts as one might expect, with Bernie Law, class of 74, playing the national anthem on a saw. The crowd stifles giggles as Bernie struggles for the right notes on a saw that's, in Bernie's words, quite sharp. More than 200 competitors made it to the Hanover Green for the 8 a.m. start, including 100 Dartmouth College alumni celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Dartmouth Outing Club.
Competitors ready. Timer's ready. 3, 2, 1, go.
Come on, get it.
There's never a lack of action at the Woodsman's Weekend. While the single buck competition runs on the southeast corner of the green, the chopping, axe throw, and obstacle course events take over the center. Fly casting and the chain throw occupy the northwest corner. And to the west, head judge Jim Porkroll Taylor, Dartmouth class of 74, teaches the crowd how to cheer for birling. Porkroll suggests spectators might want to try tiny steps or wave your arms when encouraging birlers balanced atop a log floating in a makeshift pond. But most of the time, the event is over too quickly for the crowd to say much at all.
Tiny steps.
Go!
Earl Jetty, Dartmouth's Emeritus Director of Outdoor Programs, says the Woodsman's Weekend dates back to the days of Ross McKenney, who wanted to teach outdoor skills to the men of Dartmouth.
He realized after a few years that they needed to have something more than just learning the skill. They needed to have some goal. And so he and a guy by the name of Bill Robes, who taught at Kimball Union Academy, they decided that they would have an event, a competition. So they had a competition between the two schools in 46, and it went so well that they said, we got to build this up. This is a great thing to do.
These days, Dartmouth is co-ed, and so is the Woodsman's Weekend. Schools like Harvard and MIT have dropped out and been replaced by names like Sir Sanford Fleming College from Peterborough, Ontario, and SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry from Wanakena, New York. And since nearly no one comes to college with woodsman skills these days, Earl Jetty has a lot to teach.
I never get over the feeling of watching them when they're here as first-year students and don't know which end of the axe to use, and then 4 years later, they're winning.
Dartmouth junior Alex Perez Lawrence is the women's team captain and one of the meet directors for the weekend. She certainly remembers her first team practice.
I think that was the first time I ever really held a chopping axe. But, I mean, it's so much fun because I'm a small person, so for me, I feel very strong when I'm holding an axe. Nobody's going to mess with me.
It's true. Alex is one of the smallest competitors on the green, her petite frame dwarfed by the burly physiques of most of her male and female competition. But don't think Alex takes the easy way out when practicing her favorite sport.
We fell our own trees to practice on because we need wood to practice, and we buck them up, we carry them all to our practice area, peel them, prepare them for chopping or sawing, and then just go at it.
Rory Goller is Dartmouth's staff advisor to the Woodsman's team, and he doesn't see anything unusual about a prestigious Ivy League college hosting a lumberjacking competition.
On the exterior, it looks a little bit silly to cut down a lot of trees and smash them into unusable bits, but I think that a lot of the people who do this, whether they're forestry students looking at a career in forest management or liberal arts students who are looking at a career potentially in politics, really gives you a sense of stewardship of the outdoors.
Folks like Rory are trying to get the Woodsman's team recognized as an official sport at Dartmouth. That's not a problem at places like Finger Lakes Community College and Paul Smith's College, both in upstate New York, where lumberjacking isn't just a sport, it's the sport.
I think for some of these schools, it may be the only sports team they have. You know, you got the College of Forestry and Land Management. This is their football team. You know, this is what they put everything towards. Some of these teams go dry for the season. A lot of the people take it really seriously.
Finger Lakes Community College woodsmen cheer their teammates on to a second-place finish in the horizontal chop. Brian Harrison agrees with the assessment that woodsman's is more important than football at his school.
Yeah, seeing that we don't have a football team, it's a big deal for us. It's the team that's won the most championships, and we're pretty prestigious at school.
And any idea how many championships that is?
Somebody help me out. 14? 15? 15, including last year. We're defending champions right now.
Megan Beely, Ali Sikora, and Jackie June from Paul Smith's College say the same is true at their school.
A lot of people said they didn't have football at our school, so they do woodsman's or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, plus it's co-ed.
Exactly. And they get girls. You can't complain.
The women of Paul Smith's pull their hair back in pigtails and jazz up their brown team uniforms with rainbow suspenders. But they take this sport just as seriously as the men do.
We've creeped up behind the guys. They've trained us well, and we're hoping to keep a good name for ourselves now.
It's a sport. It really is. We try to do about 3 times a week for about 2-3 hours each, and then any off time we got, any personal training, going to the gym if we want, going to the pool, the canoe, Jackie Burrell's in the pool.
Yeah, that was always a good time, purling.
Oh, man. Wait, do people look at you strange when you want to put a log in the pool?
Not at our school, really. I think that kind of stuff is acceptable at this point.
Go, Max! Go, Max!
Go, Max!
Slow.
Yeah!
Dartmouth's Max Bogren splits a biscuit on the obstacle course while his mom, Betsy, cheers him on. Betsy came all the way from Fairbanks, Alaska to see her son compete today. But that doesn't mean she's happy about how he's spending his free time at school.
In high school, he was a springboard diver, and I thought, oh, God, that's a high-risk sport. He moves on to college and does this. You know, when you watch the chopping events, you go, what in the world are they doing? You know, yeah, standing on a log and swinging a heavy, sharp object towards your legs. So as a mom, you kind of close your eyes and say, nice job. That's your only choice.
After he graduates this spring, Max will have to find another way to make his mom cringe. The skills tested during the Woodsman's Weekend don't have much use in the modern world. If he's lucky, though, he'll be like Putt Blodgett, Dartmouth class of 53, who, despite being well into his 70s, still competes once a year on Dartmouth's alumni team. And he's always looking for more teammates.
Oh, yes. This is an event that generates a tremendous amount of camaraderie and a common interest. Dartmouth didn't graduate women until 1976. So there's only 4 or 5 classes to choose from, and yet we have these over 50 women. One of them came from San Francisco, one of them from Boise, Idaho, and I tried to insult enough of the under 50 alums to make them mad enough to show up. And I think I succeeded.
When Putt's over 50 men climb on top of their logs for the three-person horizontal chop, the last event of the weekend, the PA announcer lets the crowd know that 175 years of combined woodsman's experience has lined up on the green. No one seems to mind that the old farts, as they call themselves, are still chopping long after everyone else is finished. In fact, as the current and alumni Dartmouth teammates gather for a photo and a song, no one seems to mind that not one of the Dartmouth teams is in contention for a trophy. The men and women of Dartmouth seem to feel pretty strong anyway.
And the granite of New Hampshire in their muscles and their brains. And the granite of New Hampshire in their muscles and their brains.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from Lana Grady, who met her husband, Kyle, at an earlier Santa Speedo run.
You can really find the love of your life at the Santa Speedo run.
Sorry, Kyle. My sources at the North Pole tell me Lana was really referring to the real Santa and not to a scantily clad imitation. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.